Sign up to The Economist for in-depth curated expert analysis of world events and topics ranging from business and culture to science and technology. You'll get the weekly digital edition, online-only articles, curated newsletters on politics, the markets, science, culture, and China, and full access to The Economist Podcast Plus. The Economist is independent journalism for independent thinking. Go to economist.com and get your first month free.
The following recording may contain explicit language. I can't get more explicit than may. Let's just say it may. Hey, do you want to listen to The Gist at home on your Alexa? Turns out we at Slate have built a new Alexa skill. We're perfecting it. So what you do is you say, Alexa, enable The Gist to enable the skill on your Alexa device, and then you begin playing the show. And to play it after that, you can say, Alexa, play The Gist. First enable, then play it, just on the Alexa. It's Tuesday, January 7th, 2020. From Slate, it's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. The U.S. is to pull out of Iraq. Or maybe not. Hard to say. Sorry. That was me trying to do the audio version of the emoji shrug, which I guess is an updated version of the typed emoticon shrug, which deserves to be spelled out in all its glory. Here's the audio form of that. So some background. The U.S. is in Iraq because the Iraqi government has invited the U.S. to be there. There is no status of forces agreement. Hasn't been since 2011. There is nothing other than the Iraqi prime minister, who is a weak prime minister. In fact, he's only the acting prime minister. He announced his resignation, but is holding on for a little while. And anyway, if he says go, we go. Yesterday, he received a letter from the United States saying that the United States would withdraw. And then he received another letter saying, oh, that last one was a mistake. To quote, we received a letter from the U.S. command that addressed the withdrawal 4 or 5 hours later. It was announced it was a mistake. The letter clearly indicates withdrawal from Iraq, Abdul Mahdi said during a speech addressing the Iraqi cabinet today. He explained this. The Arabic translation of one of the paragraphs was opposite of the English version. And he said the U.S. military sent a second copy of its message where the English version matched the Arabic version. So what did it say? Well, it doesn't matter because the Secretary of Defense said, ignore the first version, ignore the Arabic version, even though you are, of course, Arabic speakers. Mark Esper further added, we are a competent people who deserve to be taken seriously. We have obtained the Arabic translation of the above sentiment. This, of course, is not inconsistent with an administration that once misspelled separation in a court filing about child separation at the border. Although maybe we misread that other part, too. Maybe they were talking about child separation in Airbnbs or rooming houses, that kind of border. The administration, of course, has also misspelled Steve Bannon's name in official filings. They once misspelled Theresa May's name in advance of a visit. They dropped the H, and the British press was quick to point out that this meant the president was perhaps meeting with a porn star who is named Theresa without the H May. I'm sure President Trump would rather have done that. And just a few days after Trump swearing in, his Department of Education, its official Twitter account, misspelled the name of W.E.B. Du Bois. And in a follow-up tweet, they apologized for the error and they misspelled the word apologies. I will now spell a word for you. K-A-K-I-S-T-O-C-R-A-C-Y. Kakistocracy. It, of course, means government by the worst. But yes, even with all this said, I think we all must assume that it was a well-thought-out strategy with second and third order consequences taken into account that allowed for the president to authorize the killing of a top commander of the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Unless, wait, I thought he was already dead. You said the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. Oh no. On the show today, more on this extremely well thought out foray into, or possibly out of, or just circling around aimlessly in the sand in the Middle East. But this time it's for money. But first, there are 35 days to New Hampshire. Of course, New Hampshire is always there and will always be there, but I think you know what I meant. It's the first in the nation presidential primary. And the reason you know it is largely the doing of one man. He is New Hampshire Secretary of State William Gardner, and he was the leading force and keeper of the flame of the New Hampshire primary. A great podcast from New Hampshire Public Radio takes a really honest and at times harsh look at their home state. I will give you a clue about the tone of this podcast. It is called Stranglehold, and its co-host and reporter Lauren Chulgin is up next. This episode is brought to you by the Jordan Harbinger Show. You've heard me talk about the Jordan Harbinger Show because it's one of my favorites. He does in-depth interviews with some of the world's most fascinating minds. I can name a few: Barbara Boxer, Anderson Cooper, Michael McFaul, the Ukraine or Russia ambassador talking about Ukraine. One I recently listened to was Stanley McChrystal, the general, the former general, and he told an interesting story about revering Robert E. Lee. But then, after having a portrait of him for 40 years, he's a 63-year-old man, throwing it in the trash. Because his wife says, you know, what that picture and that man means to you, it doesn't mean to other people, and you have to understand that. And then in the interview, they got around to the point where McChrystal talked about that interview in Rolling Stone magazine that pretty much ended his career, where got to the desk of Barack Obama, and it had McChrystal saying unflattering things about the war effort, and just how he talked to his wife and how they decided not to be bitter and not to wallow in it. He could have taken some shots at the process, the reporter, or the president at that point, but he didn't. It was just an overall good interview. It was facilitated by Jordan's excellent interview style. Whether Jordan is conducting an interview or giving advice to a listener, you will find something useful that can apply to your own life in every single episode of the Jordan Harbinger Show. That could mean learning how to ask for advice the right way or discovering a little mindset tweak that changes how you see the world. Search for the Jordan Harbinger Show. That's H-A-R, like the first three letters in hard, B-I-N-G-E, as in how you'll want to catch up on all the episodes on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. You know, Idaho, they have their potatoes, and Oklahoma has their oil, now their wind farm. What does New Hampshire have? Well, it has the primary. Seriously, it is big business. It puts them on the map. As someone in the new Stranglehold podcast says, what is New Hampshire without the primary? Indeed, Stranglehold is a new podcast. Well, it's been going on for a little bit now. It's fantastic. It's really excellent. It's from New Hampshire Public Radio, and it looks inward in a way that you would imagine might be uncomfortable for many residents of the Granite State. What makes us so deserving of being number one?
This is a story about power and what people will do to keep it. A story about how and why one small state has gotten the first crack at picking presidents for so long. Because here's the secret. Here in New Hampshire, we know how valuable this primary is, how much power it gives us. We're not giving that up.
The most important thing that we can do is to save the New Hampshire primary, because without the primary, what is New Hampshire?
Lauren Chulgin is one of the reporters behind the podcast. Hey, Lauren, thanks for coming on.
Mike Pesca, thanks for having me.
So if we're going to talk about New Hampshire in the primary, we're going to talk about one person, maybe one of the most important and influential people in American politics who people from 49 states probably have never heard of, Bill Gardner. Tell me about this guy.
That is a great introduction to this person. He is like the political legend around here. And in some, you know, political circles, certainly in Washington, his name is Bill Gardner. He's been the Secretary of State since pretty much forever. He is the longest serving Secretary of State in the country. And the thing about Secretary Gardner is every 4 years when the primary rolls around, he starts being like the center of all of these political features in like the Washington Post, other big papers, because he's like this quixotic figure, this guy who has this reputation of being the guardian of the first in the nation primary. So Bill Gardner has amassed this kind of following around here and in, you know, political circles as a guy who has guarded this like extremely important tradition to us. And for many decades, as he's been in office and found ways to keep other states from getting ahead of us, he's also kind of amassed a bit of a controversial, I don't know, it's like a kind of behind the scenes controversy where a lot of people around here will see him do things as a manager of this big state office, and they won't really want to peek too closely behind the curtain because everyone believes him to be the biggest protector of this thing that's so important to us. And so when we're doing a podcast about the primary, you are correct. That was the first person we had to dig into.
And for our first episode, we are going to take a hard look at a guy with a powerful reputation around here. He's known as the guardian of the New Hampshire primary.
But while some people consider him to be an icon, others consider him a problem.
We would not have this primary today if it were not for Bill Gardner. He is the savior, the guardian of what we have here in New Hampshire, and we can be everlastingly grateful to him.
I like him as an ambassador for our First in the Nation primary, much more than I like him as a Secretary of State.
Bill Gardner's passion comes from perpetuating the cult of personality of Bill Gardner.
People know the good Bill. People do not know the bad Bill. Who's the real Bill Gardner?
It's fascinating to me. I was trying to analogize him. Robert Moses had this outsized influence in New York. And, you know, it's a little bit ridiculous to compare a Secretary of State of New Hampshire to what Robert Moses did. But he knew how to hold on to power. He wasn't really into it for the money, although he lived, you know, quite well. That wasn't really what he was into. He was the power broker. And it seems like in New Hampshire, based on the resource that New Hampshire has, this first in the nation status, that Bill Gardner is the power broker up there.
Yes. And you know that I used to cover politics in Chicago. And so I often think back to Mike Madigan, the powerful Speaker of the House, head of the Democratic Party in Illinois. It's a different situation. But as far as power broker is concerned, I think that's a totally okay connection to make between the two. Because even though Bill Gardner would tell you, you know, he's not in it for the power, that's not how he sees himself. He sees himself as a nonpartisan arbiter of elections. You know, he's the Secretary of State. It's a big job. But the thing is that over the years, he's found a way to work with the legislature to pass laws that protect our First in the Nation status. And also, the way he wields the power of those laws, basically the New Hampshire state constitution gives him the power to select the date of the primary. And so he's taken that very seriously. You could interpret that in a lot of ways. But what he does is he watches all these other states extremely closely. And if anyone even comes close to getting close to our First in the Nation spot, he finds a way to swat them away. Like in 1999, when we went toe-to-toe with Iowa, of all places, that we've shown time and time again that the state of New Hampshire, especially the political class, will stand up and fight people off. This is why we chose Stranglehold as a title, because, you know, despite all the things that the political class will tell you about how we offer such a great gift to people by being the first in the nation primary, because we're offering retail politics, and in other states, you know, candidates fly into the airplane hangar, make a press conference announcement, and then fly out, whereas here we can offer something. But, you know, sure, that's the argument. But really, when it's come time to fight over staying first, New Hampshire has really risen to the challenge, whether it's political blackmail or fighting with their so-called, you know, brother over there in the first in the nation state in Iowa. New Hampshire will not bow down to the challenge. And Bill Gardner is a huge, huge part of that.
Bill Gardner, when he sets the date, that's it. He does not change. And I did not understand how important that was to him.
It seemed like no argument, no appeal to reason, no openness to compromise would work.
Basically, it came down to this. I'm just going to cut to the chase. This is bullshit. We're New Hampshire, and God damn it, you shouldn't move. This is, you know, I don't give a shit about Iowa.
And so what's been interesting for us is as we tried to tell the full story of Bill Gardner, which is that over the last couple of years, he's become a much more controversial figure, is even in his own party. You know, he is a registered Democrat, and yet conservatives have kind of really rushed to back him lately because he takes a lot of stances on voting issues that are much more aligned with the Republican Party than the Democratic Party. And it's kind of put Democrats in a weird spot where they feel like a lot of longstanding lawmakers feel like, well, we've got a relationship with this guy. He keeps the primary first. You know, what are we supposed to do here? This is completely against what we believe. So they've been in kind of a rocky spot. And so when his last time for re-election, and I should say he's elected by the New Hampshire legislature, which I'm sure you know is massive, that became a really interesting moment for them to kind of reflect on who they really want in that position.
Now, Gardner, so this is an irony. Here's the guy who's the guardian of elections. He's not even popularly elected. He's elected, but selected by the state legislature, and it's every 2 years, right?
Yes, it is. And for many, many, many years, there really wasn't much of an election to be had. It was kind of like a pro forma situation because he was so popular. And I should say, you know, despite all this controversy that I was just talking about, he is extremely popular in the state legislature and he's known around the state. So, you know, it's been a pretty easy thing for him to run for quote unquote re-election with all of his peers, except for his most recent election, which came down to like a nail biter, which, you know, everyone was kind of taken aback by. And the question at the end of the day for many lawmakers was, if we don't have Gardner, who's going to keep the first in the nation primary? Because that, I'm telling you, is the thing around here.
Yes. So how important is it? How important is it? Well, what about monetarily as opposed to just the psychic value? Is there a way to put a number on it?
Well, it's hard to really put a very complete number on it, but I will say institutions like my own alma mater, St. Anselm College, a small liberal arts college here, you know, the debates from CNN, all these big places would come in every 4 years and be hosted at the college. The college could then advertise to students, myself included, here's a brochure, look how you can get involved with the primary, the presidential elections. So UNH, same thing, New England College. So, you know, that's not nothing. That's certainly money going into a place that it wouldn't otherwise. WMUR is our only television station. They get crazy ad revenue from candidates who want to obviously have television ads on the one TV station in New Hampshire. And that I should not even forget also that there are a lot of people who in the political class have made long careers off of this. There are people like who started on the Jimmy Carter campaign, Jean Shaheen among them, who would go on to governor of New Hampshire and of course is now one of our most senior U.S. senators. So this thing has certainly helped a lot of people. And it's benefited me too, which we've been like very open about on the podcast, that the New Hampshire primary also benefits reporters and young college kids like myself who thought it was awesome to be able to talk to candidates at my school and then benefited from them, obviously, by, you know, being able to be interviewed by reporters and then get internships. I mean, so yeah, I would say it's hard to put an exact number on, but it's definitely, there's definitely benefits.
So here you are, you're sticking your thumb in the eye of this supposedly beloved institution. What kind of reaction are you getting from the people of New Hampshire and the person who is the topic of your first episode, Bill Gardner?
Okay, well, first, the people, it's certainly been split. I will say that everyday voters, we had a survey early on asking voters, like, what do you want in your primary coverage? And a lot of people from New Hampshire wanted to know, why the hell are we first? So we were like, well, this is good. We should tackle that. If people who live here don't know, that's a great thing to help them understand. So I would say that a lot of voters are really happy about it. We've also heard from people from other states who are like, finally, I understand why this thing is first. And now I like feel like I understand it and its place in this, you know, larger tradition of picking presidents. And that's great. But we've also got a lot of pushback from people who have, you know, started political careers off of this thing, or people who feel we're not saying enough about the great, you know, the greatness that the New Hampshire primary should provide. I guess separate from that, as far as Bill Gardner is concerned, you know, we had tried many times to reach out to him because we really wanted to talk to him for the first episode. He, at that time, had said that he wouldn't do an interview with us until he announced the date of the first in the nation primary, which I should say is only up to him. So he is the only person who knew when he would do that. So obviously that meant that he was not going to be sitting down with us. And since that point, we have heard and we're recording at a point when he told another national reporter that this podcast that we put together is full of lies and untruths. And so we, of course, then were like, well, you know, we would really like to talk to you about that. What are you talking about? And he said he hadn't heard it. So he still wouldn't do an interview unless we did it on his terms in the middle of this big press conference about announcing the date of the primary. And so instead, we kind of put an episode together last minute that just showed why he says he thinks it's full of untruths, which is that he doesn't want to, he hasn't listened to it, and other thoughts that he had about the first in the nation primary that he expressed in that press conference. And that's about as far as we've gotten. But I think the short answer would be he doesn't seem to be very happy with it, even though he didn't listen.
Do you think if this were, I don't know, 12 years ago and podcasting weren't the phenomena that it is, and you were mostly playing to just or almost entirely playing to a New Hampshire crowd, would this have been the kind of undertaking that the station was eager to commit to?
That is a very good question, because some of what we've been doing as we think about looking at this as an institution has had to look back at our own coverage. Mm-hmm. And we, too, have done coverage that really was like, oh, how cute is the primary? And so we are just as, I guess, guilty of this guardianship protective nature that I'm talking about, where that I've seen in other organizations. And I think that because we've shown that we can do investigative stories, we can tell big stories, that we can do narrative stories, that made the newsroom feel like we could take a risk and pulling me off the trail and investing in a big question like this and looking at the primary in a different way. But I also think that podcasts are a big part of it, because it would be a whole other thing to, you know, where would we have put it, right? I mean, mm-hmm, you know, mm-hmm. Public radio back then was all, we're newscasts, we're by the clock. And I feel like we've all started to take a lot of risks lately about where we can put things and how we can tell stories. But I would like to think that, you know, I cherish my colleagues and I think very highly of them. And I'm sure back then what my colleague Josh Rogers was here at that point, and I know that he was thinking critically about the primary back then, too.
Lauren Chooljian's podcast, Stranglehold, has a stranglehold on my imagination. It is excellent. You're going to hear so much about the New Hampshire primary. Just take 1 second to step back and ask why. Lauren Chooljian is a reporter for New Hampshire Public Radio. Thank you, Lauren.
I'm Dr. Megan Sachs.
And I'm Dr. Amy Sloshberg.
And we're the host of the podcast Campus Killings. Our show covers some of the most sinister crimes to take place on or around school campuses, or the cases we discuss have a school-connected theme.
And with the new school year comes an all-new second season of Campus Killings, which will debut on September 16th, 2023.
But if you want to listen to Campus Killings now, you can binge all the episodes from season one, available everywhere you listen to podcasts.
And now the spiel. The Trump administration wants Iraq to pay us to leave. This is the stupidest thing ever, except, of course, for the last stupidest thing ever. But this is stupider than most of the stupidest things. Because the other stupidest things are things where non-stupid people know they're stupid and, you know, allow the president to have a little bit of a tantrum, but then put the stupid thing in a desk drawer or otherwise ignore it. Example of that, stupid thing, I will bomb your cultural sites. To Trump, by the way, a cultural site is a casino or maybe the Access Hollywood bus. But then the Secretary of Defense, Mark Esper, perhaps risking the wrath of the president, says, no, we're not going to do that. It is so stupid. Perhaps adding, maybe someday, Mr. Trump, you will thank me if you ever find yourself in The Hague and it takes the judges a full hour to deliberate on your guilt rather than 45 minutes. Remember those extra 15 minutes I did that for you. Now, this now is the real stupidest thing.
He also said this, quote, we have a very extraordinarily expensive airbase that's there. It cost billions of dollars to build long before my time. We're not leaving unless they pay us back for it.
Okay, it's not the adverb modifying another adverb that is definitely frequently a thing President Trump does. What I mean is this. Since the U.S. troops are in Iraq at the invitation of the Iraqis, like I said, and the prime minister just has to say go, and we have to go if he says go, then what this means is if we don't go, we will be invading Iraq. In other words, it essentially, the demand, which can never and will never be met, the demand essentially boils down to pay us or else this will count as an invasion and an occupation. And we would have no leverage in getting any money out of this. It is the world's worst extortion racket. I would say the world's worst protection racket, but it's really more like a lack of protection racket. Now, the troops are already there. So it wouldn't be an invasion in the strictest sense, more like, I don't know, existing cells turning cancerous and fighting against your own body. He is basically turning, or would like to turn, the U.S. armed forces into sleeper cells. Fantastic. You know what? Let's rename our divisions. The Fighting Fourth, nah, the Shakedown Squadron. The Squatting Fourth, we could call them. It might not register. When you heard the news, you might have not had it register as much as some of the other crazy stuff. Oh, that's not totally wacko bananas. Maybe because, I don't know, things like gaslighting habituation. But also because on some level, maybe it has some logical appeal. I mean, in general, Americans don't want to be ripped off. In general, Americans think we've spent too much in Iraq. In general, Americans don't want to be in a foreign country where they're not wanted. But seriously, this demand is far, far stupider and more implausible than buying Greenland or nuking hurricanes or stocking the wall with alligators. At least the stocking and acquisition of alligators is a domestic task in an area over which the U.S. has sovereignty and clearly, by the way, falls within Jared Kushner's portfolio. The White House also leaked to the media that it is not only the ill-informed fantasy of Captain Crazy Pants, it is an actual plan in the works. How? Trump wants money for an airbase that advances U.S. interests that will henceforth not be used by the U.S. because Trump ruined things. And at least one person in the employ of the executive branch takes that set of facts and says, okay, let's see how to word that. Let me read from a Washington Post report where the headline is, after Trump's threat, administration begins drafting possible sanctions against Iraq. Yeah, that was another part of it, that we're going to sanction Iraq for this. But here it says he, meaning Trump, also demanded Iraq reimburse the United States billions of dollars for investments made in an airbase there as a precursor for any troops leaving. Broad confusion remains over how the United States will respond to those demands. Defense Secretary Mark T. Esper said on Monday that the United States has not decided to leave Iraq after a letter surfaced in which the U.S. military said to Iraqi officials that U.S. forces would be relocating. Yes, confusion remains how the United States will respond to Donald Trump's demands. The demand that we get paid to leave. This is essentially the might and power of the U.S. government coalescing to pursue a harassment lawsuit. Now, to take a further step out, I have noticed over the years that there is this trend in press coverage of what the administration is said to be drafting. Sometimes it's legit. I mean, the policies aren't good, but sometimes the administration really does draft something and it goes into effect. A lot of times with the EPA, this happens because the executive branch has really firm control over the EPA. Most of the backsliding on the environment that the administration would like to go into effect has gone into effect, thank God. But with so much of the other said to be drafting type reporting, let us now review. The Washington Post did a story about the plan to deny green cards to people who use public assistance too much. This was called the public charge rule. The Post says, quote, the rule has been the top priority of Stephen Miller, the architect of Mr. Trump's immigration agenda. Mr. Miller has repeatedly pushed administration officials to finish drafting the regulation known as the public charge rule. Well, the rule was drafted. Cut two.
Last week, three separate federal judges blocked the public charge rule from being implemented. One judge said the government did not give an adequate reason for why the change was needed.
This is just like that perfect replacement for the ACA or the travel ban, or when the Commerce Department was said to be drafting an inclusion of a citizenship question on the 2020 census. Here is the ultimate upshot of how that went.
President Trump retreating from his push to add a citizenship question to the 2020 census after a week of insisting his administration would continue to fight the issue.
Many of these said to be draftings never reach a final form, but very often they do, and very often when they do not stand up to legal scrutiny. I suppose you could say that the administration was said to be drafting a raft of tariffs against China, and then they did draft them, and then they did impose them. But even so, I think it falls into this category because they didn't work. It's a cycle of crazy claim, oh, he can't be serious. Yes, he's serious. In fact, he's drafting, and draft is now proposal. But at some point along the line, and sometimes not until the end, it all crumbles into nothingness. It's almost as if so many of these terrible ideas were either destined to fail or never meant to actually work. My analysis is that the Trump administration is just as happy to get people mad as it is to get stuff done. In fact, maybe the president prefers the former over the latter. Getting stuff done requires care and follow through. But lobbing an id-driven proposal just feels really good in the moment. Maybe like lobbing a missile at an adversary. The Trump administration never learns or doesn't care that there's a difference between making a proclamation and making a policy. It's the difference between loudly getting attention and properly giving it. And that's it for today's show. The Gist was produced in part by Christopher Johnson, who edited the Stranglehold interview, or as the Trump administration spells it, Spangled Bread. Daniel Schrader doesn't produce The Gist. Wait, sorry, that was the Arab translation. He does produce the, I don't know, I guess he does, maybe. He has no plans at this point not to produce The Gist. If he stops, he definitely wants money for leaving. It's hard to say. The Gist. When I retire, I will be billing you for all the hours you listened, but failed to use the appropriate promo codes. Oompuru depuru dupuru, and thanks for listening.